Thank you, John. Well, what we're going to do is we'll extend this a little bit. We're already past the end time, but we'll extend a little bit further. If any of our presenters do have to drop off, just let me know, and we'll get you your questions via email and get written responses. And likewise, if any of the attendees have to drop off, this webinar has been or is being recorded, so you'll get the full Q&A session in the recording. So we'll maybe take about 10 more minutes for questions at this point. So the first question is, well, actually, I think there's one more question. I know John addressed one of the questions within his presentation, and John, I'll ask you this next one that came in. How does facility location strategy change with different types of products in the supply chain, functional versus innovative products, being moved? For instance, what you think fuel price change would affect location strategy or industrial space change needed for innovative products compared to your large food company example?
Yeah, so I think quickly that the real distinction here is the amount, it's the freight percent of total cost of goods. So if you are a pharma company, a high tech company, and freight is 1 to 2% of cost of goods, the impact of fuel price changes on your network is going to be limited or even insignificant. But if you're a distributor, a retailer, where freight as percent of goods is percent of cost is over 10%. That fuel impact on your most efficient, most effective network will be significant. At this point, we are seeing that fuel as a percent of total transportation cost in some points in time is becoming more expensive than equipment and sometimes more than labor. But if you're a distributor and a shipper and a manufacturer, and freight is 1% of COGS, that doesn't really matter. So I think it's freight percent of total cost that's really the driver there.
All right, thank you. Chris, we'll go back to a question for you that was typed in. The question is, I heard U.S. DOT Secretary Ray LaHood make the statement, build it and they will come, in a manner that implied his support of the older philosophy to infrastructure construction. I think that attitude needs to change at the highest levels and wonder what you might suggest to change those attitudes.
Well, it was an interesting comment, and I think that within the context of where it was offered, it was actually a reasonable point. I think that Secretary LaHood was basically pointing to the fact that you can absolutely make the case that we have not kept up with our infrastructure needs in terms of investment where congestion and high demand are in place, that we have fallen behind on the investment in those particular areas. And as a result, some facility location decisions that would naturally have gone to a certain place because of demand as well as the access to labor and other factors has been held off because the infrastructure simply cannot support it. I think a lot of this then kind of comes back to a point that I made early on, which is a good understanding at a regional level, at a multi-state level, with regards to where supply chains are moving and the dynamics that are pressing upon them, whether they be fuel cost or congestion or access to nodes or what have you, that we have a better understanding as to what those pressures are and then make the investments appropriately based upon what the opportunity is for that region.
Okay, thank you. And then we'll go, Van, we have some questions for you. What is the significance of the different colors in the megapolitan maps?
You'd have to ask Virginia Tech. I just use the colors that they had on their map. There's really no significance to it at all. They simply wanted to differentiate the areas.
Okay.
Stand out visually.
All right. Next question for you. How is the annual volume required for daily service calculated?
The question that was intended to answer was to establish a daily connection between an OD pair, an origin and destination pair, two cities. How many units would you have to have daily service? What's the minimum number? So for a truck, obviously it's one load a day and one truck a day. That's 365 in the course of a year. For the rail, for intermodal service, you're talking about a unit train. Let's say just for general principles that we're talking 100 cars on that train. Each one of those cars would be double stacked, so that's 200 units. So you take the 200 units, you multiply it by the 200 units a day, and the 365 a year, you get the numbers that we've generated.
the next question for you. Does BNSF Railway still have a minimum operational threshold for operating considering the operations of intermodal trains? I had heard previously that BNSF would only operate an intermodal train that would travel in excess of 500 miles. In other words, is my understanding that 500 miles or so is the minimum geographic threshold for operating intermodal trains because short-distance intermodal trains aren't economically viable for the BNSF Railway and other railroads?
To kind of go back to the CSX and NS maps that I put up there, you see a great deal of density, and you saw a 100-mile radius around those particular sites. In the east, because of everything, ultimately it all comes down to dollars. You're basically competing against the truck. So if you have an area that's highly congested, if you have very high fuel prices, such as John and Chris both talked about, the higher those prices go, the more congested, and the higher the price of trucking, then the more competitive rail becomes at shorter distances. So in the east, they have a 500 to 700 mile movement on the average for their intermodal traffic. We in the UP and CP and the CN, Canadian National, generally are well over 1,000 miles, closer to 2,000 miles in terms of our average. It really is not a matter of how much money you're making on the particular unit either, because really it's, you're talking about trains. You have a limited capacity. You have a rail line, and so if I take a train that is loaded with freight that comes out of LA and wants to go to Chicago, it's going to move 2,000 miles. Very little stop in that point, and I have to take that train away, and I put a train that's going to move 100 miles up to the high desert, let's say, to an intermodal facility. There is no amount of money that I can make to move that 100 miles that is going to match that train, that opportunity cost I have of replacing a train that goes to Chicago. So the answer is, it depends. As prices get higher, fuel prices get higher, which they're inevitably going to do, as congestion gets greater, as it appears that it's inevitably going to do, then you'll see somewhat shorter intermodal. But as long as we have a fixed size of a pipe and you're replacing a high-value train with a lower-value train, it's probably not going to happen. So is it 500 miles? Is it 250 miles? It's at $5 a gallon, highway diesel is somewhere between the 250 and the 500, probably, minimum.
All right. And one more question for you. How does BNSF balance the desire to minimize its number of key intermodal corridors with the possibility of disruption events that could temporarily close one of those key corridors? Obviously, these events are very unlikely to occur, but would be highly disruptive if they do happen.
Well, we've had some of those events. We had the flooding last year, which was a pretty significant impact. It displaced a lot of the coal traffic in the United States. To some extent, it put some of the utilities at risk of running out of fuel. We had to run on other people's railroads, which we do. Fortunately, there's more than one railroad in the United States, so we ran on other people's lines. In the intermodal world, depending on what happens in that regard, we'll put it on truck. We do that. But I'm not going to get too detailed because we have from a security standpoint, we really can't talk about it too much, but we do have enterprise continuity plans, highly sophisticated plans for how to deal with freight emergencies in the U.S. And fortunately, major emergencies that we have had, such as the floods, we've generally been able to respond very effectively and very quickly. So it's a risk. It's something that we're very conscious of. But it really would not change the way in which we distribute our facilities.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think we did make it through all of the questions, so we'll go ahead and close out today. I do want to thank our three presenters. Thank you everybody in attendance as well, and thank you for holding out about 15 extra minutes or so. I think we got through some good presentations and some good questions. The recorded version of today's webinar will be available within the next few weeks on the Talking Freight website, and I'll send out an email once that is available. As a reminder, if you're an AICP member and would like to receive 1.5 certification maintenance credits for today, please make sure that you were either signed in with your first and last name or have your name typed into the chat box if you're attending with a group. I encourage everybody online to download the evaluation form that's in the box in the bottom right corner of your screen and fill it out and send it back to me after you've completed it. In addition, as I mentioned before, we do have all presentations from today as well as the NCFRP reports available in the file share box, and those will be posted online as well. The next seminar will be held on August 15th and will be about freight considerations and traffic incident management. Please visit the Talking Freight website shown on the slide on your screen to register for this webinar. So with that, we'll go ahead and close out for today. Thank you, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day.